Marsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Doug Marsh, and I represent the petitioner appellant William Kerr. Your Honors, William Kerr should have already been eligible for parole. However, because of the ineffectiveness of his counsel, he won't be eligible for parole for at least another 11 years. William Kerr received ineffective assistance of counsel for two reasons. First, because his trial counsel gave him materially incorrect information regarding the sentence for first-degree reckless homicide, which was the charge contained in the state's plea offer.
How do we know that? I looked at the information that you cited, and I thought it was very short on solid evidence about what the state's... Apparently there was a plea order, and there's some vague talk about that, but what's your best evidence that that's what the state was offering?
Well, first of all, the best evidence is Kerr's affidavit testifying that he was in fact offered first-degree reckless homicide as the plea on the morning of the first day of trial. And secondly, he also wrote a letter on July 5th of 2005 to his trial counsel and asking numerous questions with respect to the plea of first-degree reckless homicide. For instance, he asked whether or not his trial counsel had a paper copy of that plea offer. His trial counsel, and also in that letter, Kerr straightforwardly told his trial counsel, I as well as you, remember that I was offered a plea of first-degree reckless homicide just before my jury selection.
Well, okay, so and Kerr says this, but looking at the responsive letter that comes back from the July 6th letter, right, which is in the separate appendix you've given us, I don't see any corroboration that that's what this is. And we're dealing with habeas corpus, after all. We're not dealing with other kinds of proceedings. All she says is, at no time did Mr. Williams offer any type of deal that was sufficient until the morning of the trial. That was not in writing. He doesn't have to put it in writing. He's not going to put it in writing. I mean, you know, it's... I think this is an awfully thin read, actually.
Your Honor, it's strengthened by the close proximity in date of response to Kerr's initial letter. And Kerr, like I mentioned numerous times, five times, I believe, referred to the plea of first-degree reckless homicide.
Kerr says this, but do we know? We have no evidence from the state that that was the nature of the plea bargain. We have no evidence. I don't think that the letter back from the lawyer, which actually has a slightly irritated tone to it, gives us that evidence. And so if we don't think that there's enough evidence that this was what was at the heart of things, doesn't this part of the case, I mean, I realize it doesn't touch the provocation argument you're making, but doesn't this part of the case fall apart?
If this court believes the factual record is not sufficient to find that he was given a plea of first-degree reckless homicide, we request that it would order the district court to grant an evidentiary hearing on whether or not he was in fact offered a plea of first-degree reckless homicide. Kerr did make efforts to try to develop, to the best of his abilities, information with respect to whether or not he was given that offer. And, in fact, as the July 6th response letter indicates, the offer was not in writing. And that July 6th letter also doesn't dispute Kerr's multiple assertions that he was, in fact, offered the plea of first-degree reckless homicide. He wrote other letters to his trial counsel prior to that July 5th letter inquiring about the plea offer and was never given explicit response stating, yes, you were in fact offered that, just the implicit admission that arises from his counsel's failure to dispute his multiple assertions that he was offered a plea of first-degree reckless homicide.
Well, we do have the sentencing transcript, correct, which also it doesn't discuss the specific terms of the deal, but he and his lawyer had an exchange on the record in which it's clear that there was an offer made and it was rejected. And we have Kerr telling us because it was the bad advice, right?
That's correct. There is the sentencing hearing transcript where his trial counsel admits that there was an offer made. And there is no dispute that an offer was made. I don't think that his trial counsel ever disputed that.
I think it's the only important is, though, what was the offer? You could imagine it would have been an offer for a lower sentence for the first degree intentional, or it could have been an offer for a second degree intentional, or it could have been an offer for a first degree reckless. And the sentences are different, you know, for these various things. So whether the lawyer made a mistake or not is dependent on facts that we don't know.
I believe the lawyer did make a mistake, and as Your Honor mentioned, the sentencing hearing transcript reflects that. In that sentencing hearing transcript, trial counsel states, and I quote, "You now understand that we really had no offer other than the possibility of your pleading to life imprisonment with a statutory minimum." And now the sentence for first-degree intentional homicide was life imprisonment with a 13-year statutory minimum. That's as a result, comparing that to Kerr's counsel's quote, clearly Kerr's counsel must have been mistaken as to the sentence for the plea offer. He told Kerr that it was effectively the same as the sentence that he was for the crime he was charged with. So that also gives further evidence that he was, in fact, offered a plea of first-degree reckless homicide.
I think it's indirect because without knowing the rest of these details, it's just not clear to me that this was automatically a plea for first-degree. I guess that's a mandatory life in prison, right?
First-degree reckless homicide?
First-degree intentional is mandatory life in prison, but then a certain period of time, after a certain period of time has elapsed, you are at least eligible for parole. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So let me come at this a different way, too, which is to ask what evidence didn't come in. I mean, the jury was given a number of lesser-included alternatives for its sentencing at the trial. I mean, and what evidence is there that Kerr really, other than his way after the fact affidavit, the state argues that, in fact, Kerr's lawyer testified at that sentencing hearing that he did inform him about the plea. Kerr didn't want it. Kerr was really trying to go with this defense, this provocation idea, other kinds of things that he thought were justifying.
First of all, as Your Honor mentioned, there is the affidavit, but in addition to that, this court in both Julian versus Barley and Moore versus Bryant noted that a large disparity between the sentence that a defendant believed he was going to receive under a plea offer as a result of his counsel's incorrect advice compared with the sentence the defendant would have actually received under the true plea offer constitutes objective evidence that supports a defendant's affidavit stating that he would have accepted the plea. So here, there is a large disparity between the sentence that actually would have been given under the plea. That sentence was from anywhere from 0 to 40 years imprisonment with parole eligibility beginning after one quarter of the sentence and presumptive mandatory release after two-thirds of the sentence.
Mr. Marsh, can I ask you to back up? I didn't hear clearly the name of the case you were relying upon on the your point a second ago.
Sure. There are two cases, actually, Your Honor.
Okay.
Julian versus Bartley.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And Moore versus Bryant.
Julian and Moore. Okay. Thank you.
And
if I can get this clear in my mind, you say there is no dispute about what the plea offer was?
The factual record, we assert, does demonstrate that the plea offer was first-degree reckless homicide. Kerr has been consistent.
That's based on the pro se filings of your client?
That's based on his affidavit, the July 6th letter that
that's
we previously...
That's all pro se, though, right?
That's right. That's right.
And so the only... to somewhat pick up on Judge Wood was asking, the only thing we have is pro se pleadings, affidavits, and other things that were filed both in the Milwaukee County Circuit Court and in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, right?
That's true. And Kerr has been consistent throughout his pro se proceedings in asserting that he was offered first-degree reckless homicide. In his brief to the Wisconsin Circuit Court, he mentioned that he referred to his counsel's misadvice as to not telling him the difference between first-degree intentional homicide, which was the charged crime, and first-degree reckless homicide, which was the plea offer, and also stated that his counsel never sought a counteroffer of, say, he gave the example of second-degree reckless homicide, which further suggests that he, in fact, was offered a plea of first-degree reckless homicide. Now, moving back to his counsel's deficient advice, Kerr, like I mentioned, was told by his trial counsel that the sentence for first-degree reckless homicide was mandatory life imprisonment with a 13-year statutory minimum. As I mentioned before, the actual sentence was 0 to 40 years.
I still have to go back to what the state courts did now with this, because the state court judge, the collateral proceeding judge, really says Mr. Kerr, you're way too vague for me to have any idea what you're talking about. And then finally you kind of turn over the page and you get to the judge saying, oh, by the way, even if you actually had raised it, I wouldn't have found this to be solid grounds for Strickland-like relief. But doesn't the state judge's initial statement that this that there really just isn't enough evidence to show what that plea offer was, isn't that something that we need to pay some heed to?
Well, here, Your Honor, Kerr at that point was unable to fully develop the factual record. He didn't.
But he has his affidavit. If what we're really relying on is just his affidavit, then he could file his affidavit any time.
He could have filed an affidavit. However, he didn't have – the record reflects that he didn't have access to the sentencing hearing transcript, which confirmed that his counsel did, in fact, give him misadvice as to the plea of first-degree reckless homicide, and he also didn't have that July 6th letter. And it's further important to note that Kerr did attempt to develop the factual record at the state court level. He wrote two letters to both his state appellate defender as well as two letters to his trial counsel requesting a full copy of his trial transcript. And both his trial counsel and his state appellate defender told him, you do have a copy, but that, in fact, wasn't the truth. He was missing that sealed sentencing hearing transcript.
But I just have to say, I mean, Kerr has known all along, presumably, what the content of any offer the state gave him was. Maybe he didn't know the sentence that attached to it, but he's known the content. And the state, this is Judge Sankovitz, the state judge says, further, I do not know what offer, if any, had been made by the state to resolve the case in a lesser charge. And then he goes on to have his alternative ruling. But I guess that's worrisome to me, since it suggests that there's really just no competent evidence on that.
He didn't put an affidavit forward to the circuit court. However, had he even done that, he still didn't have access to evidence to corroborate that. It would have just been his recollection, and it's quite. Your Honor, I noticed.
No. Answer the question.
Okay. And I've got one more. Okay.
It's possible that that's all he would have been left with, which would not have therefore even been sufficient at that point still to have a meritorious claim. You needed that evidence, the sealed sentencing hearing transcript, the July 6th letter, to even corroborate his affidavit.
Okay.
Just one more question. In that discussion by the circuit judge, we get the statement that may come as close as we come to a merits judgment by the state courts on this plea issue. Even if the state offered to resolve the late case on a lesser charge, such as first-degree reckless homicide, Mr. Kerr might still be serving a sentence which would make him ineligible for parole until 2021, in which case Mr. Kerr would not be able to demonstrate that he was prejudiced by going to trial. That's clearly wrong, isn't it? The 2021 date?
Yes, Your Honor, that is clearly wrong.
He would have been, if it had been a first-degree reckless homicide plea, he would have been eligible for parole no later than 10 years after he began serving the sentence. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay.
And may I?
Sure.
Add? That's true, and that's where the prejudice element is demonstrated here, is because had Kerr been given the very maximum sentence under the plea offer, he would have been eligible for parole after 10 years, which would have been August of 2009.
But in terms of meeting the ADEPA standard, that's just a flat-out mistake as a matter of state law.
That's absolutely correct, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he would have accepted the plea because it gave him a substantially better offer.
Thank you. Ms. Lloyd?
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd, representing the respondent in this habeas matter. Respondent asked that this Court hold that under Mr. Kerr's first claim, that the circuit court decision that starts with that part about in a final mishmash is entitled to deference under the ADPA.
I don't see why it is, though, because I think the state failed to argue procedural default properly, and it's quite possible for the state to waive such a claim.
Right, and I think that I could have certainly done a better job of arguing procedural default, but I think that he does, the circuit court does address the merits of claim in that second paragraph.
It's very fuzzy, though. I mean.
Well, and it's very fuzzy because
suppose we were to review it under, you know, as justice and law require standard.
Okay, well, under that standard, I think Mr. Kerr still loses because, A, his claim remains entirely speculative. I still have no idea what the district attorney offered, and even assuming he offered first-degree reckless homicide, I don't understand where there's any corroboration for the idea that Mr. Kerr would have taken that plea had he understood the proper or the correct sentencing range that he would have faced. It seems to me that this is a defendant who went to trial and banked on self-defense and lost and now wants to go back and take the plea.
So at the trial, Mr. Kerr's primary strategy was self-defense?
That's my understanding, yes.
Which, of course, would be a complete defense. It wasn't just provocation, which would have kicked
him
down.
He didn't argue adequate provocation. I don't know if it was a the unreasonable belief that you're in danger, that form of imperfect self-defense, as well as a perfect self-defense with the threatening statements made by the victim.
Right. I mean, because the adequate provocation point is his other ground of support for the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right. And the circuit court found that under the facts of the case, he wouldn't have been entitled to that instruction, which I think is a state law finding that's entitled to deference by this court. And I think that it's also just another example of, even if you're not looking under the AEDPA, if you're just looking under Strickland, I think the counsel made a reasoned decision to pursue the defenses of self-defense and not adequate provocation. There was a police officer outside of Mr. Kerr's residence within 5 minutes of when he killed the victim. I think it's hard to, I think it strains any reasonable argument to say that he was adequately provoked in those 5 minutes to kill the victim. Mm-hmm. So under either the AEDPA, which I do think this court should find that this case is under, but even if it doesn't, I don't think he's shown law and justice require reversal here. There's just no Strickland prejudice.
But what are we to do with this mistake that Judge Hamilton mentioned by the state judge? The state judge seems to have confused the date of presumptive mandatory parole under the first-degree reckless homicide with his actual parole eligibility date, which would have been much earlier than 2021.
Right.
And, you know, so that's just all bollocked up. And if the judge had been comparing apples to apples, he would have seen that there certainly was prejudice.
Well, I don't know that there is prejudice because you're not entitled to parole. Just because you're eligible for parole, you can't...
At least you have a shot at it, though.
Right, but you can't show that you would have gotten a better deal.
From the sentencing hearing, though, we know that both the prosecutor and the judge were actually fairly complimentary of this man who had just been convicted of intentional homicide.
Right, but he still killed someone and could have very easily received a sentence of 40 years, which would make him eligible for parole in 10 years, which would
last
probably
summer.
Be
mm-hmm.
sometime this year, right? And then mm-hmm. He might not get it, though, and his presumptive mandatory release would be 2025, which is 4 years after when he's now eligible for parole.
But it's just parole eligibility with no presumption in
right.
his favor. There's surely... Wisconsin hasn't drawn these lines just for fun. There's bound to be a difference.
I don't think there's prejudice under Strickland, though. I mean, there may be the possibility that there'd be something different, but a reasonable probability of a different result had he pled? I mean, first of all,
the parole eligibility would have come up much sooner, and if he was somebody, you know, not to excuse any homicide, of course, but what was an assessment of his risk to the rest of the community would, I assume, be part of what the parole board looks at.
Right. And I don't know how he's behaved in prison. I don't know. It's just so speculative. I just don't think that it meets the prejudice standard under Strickland. I think we could continue to talk about it, and it's possible. I just don't think it's prejudicial.
So your position as a matter of law is that if state law draws a distinction between discretionary parole and mandatory presumptive parole, that's not something that's such a difference that it has any meaning at federal habeas?
Well, not under Strickland, under prejudice, to show prejudice that, I mean, in a situation where you know, he was going to get out maybe before 2021, which he now has. If that were the case, I think that would be a different story. But as it is, it's just entirely unknown what's going to happen or what would have happened. And additionally, I still don't think that he's made any showing that he would have pled guilty had he known the correct sentencing range that he faced, other than
well,
his affidavit.
He's testified to that, and we know that there's a big discrepancy. What more could he do?
Well, he could have properly raised the issue in state court to warrant an evidentiary hearing, which he never did. Mm-hmm. I mean, other than his affidavit, the fact that he didn't have these things that supposedly corroborate his now his current affidavit, I don't see why they weren't I don't see why they weren't available to him sooner. He could have said to the state court, he was at sentencing, he could have said there's a portion of the transcript that, you know, supports my claim. And he didn't do that. He didn't do that on direct appeal, and he didn't do that in his 97406 motion.
Okay, but that's your procedural default argument that you didn't make in the district court, right?
Right, but the same claim was before the circuit court that he would have pled guilty, and he didn't make the showing that he needed to do there, and that decision saying that you didn't show this and there's no prejudice, even if you could have shown it, I think is what we look at. In addition, I think that the case, I'm not positive about this, but I think that the cases Julian and Moore that petitioner relies upon to talk about the discrepancy between sentence possibilities are both cases where the defendants pled guilty instead of going to trial because they were misinformed about what the charge on that they would go to trial entailed, the sentence range for the trial charge was, as opposed to in this case where he didn't plead guilty and instead went to trial. So I think that there's a difference between those two as far as right to trial and, you know, right to a plea bargain. So,
Ms. Lloyd, if the court were to agree with the defendant or with the petitioner on the plea agreement issue, what should the appropriate disposition be? Should it be to order a new trial? Should it be to order modification of the judgment?
Well, I guess
should it be something else? I think Julian and Moore both indicate there's a fair amount of discretion as to what the remedy should be.
Okay. Well, I mean, on this record, I still find it very difficult to understand how you could make a factual finding that he would have pled guilty. But
let's assume for purposes of argument that it comes out the other way.
Well, he's not entitled to that plea at this point. I mean, he's entitled to, if you were to find that that was an error, then I think he would be entitled to a new trial.
You want to try the? Would you want to try the case 12 years after the events?
No, I'm not a trial attorney, but I assume that the district attorney would look at the case. And,
I mean you, the state.
Right. Well, and I don't know. I'm not Milwaukee County. I can't speak for what they would want to do. I assume that they would be interested in a plea. I don't know. I'm just not qualified to speak to that. But I think that the remedy would be to vacate the proceedings. I don't think that this court has the authority to allow or make him plead or make the state take a plea at this point. Thank you.
Mr. Marsh, you were appointed by the court to represent your client in this case?
That's correct.
And you have the appreciation and thanks to the court for your vigorous representation of your client. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement. We move to the